Welcome, everybody, to The Rad Life, the only talk radio show that takes you along with host and age explorer Rod Gontos on his continuing journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older. The Rad Life is brought to you this week by Your Home for a Lifetime, a company dedicated to empowering you to stay safely, independently, and comfortably in your own home. And now here is your host, Rad Gontos.
Hello, Paul.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
How are you doing?
We're actually doing this at a different time period. We'll see how this works here. We're going to pre-tape this. They're going to figure it out.
We're pre-taping this, so if you're listening to us, don't call in. No, but you can always email me at Rod, R-A-A-D, period, Gantos, G-H-A-N-T-O-U-S, at gmail.com, or you can call me at 949-212-8299. And let me know what you think about the show, or if you have any questions for our guest, et cetera. You can reach me not 24/7, but pretty close to that. So, and if you're on Facebook, Facebook, you probably will stumble upon me at some point, and also let me know what you think about the show. I really would like to know what you guys think about the show. It's been almost 3 years, and I was thinking about that over the weekend. I actually attended a college reunion.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I know Paul here hates it when I bring up my college in Switzerland.
First he goes to Switzerland, then he goes to college
No.
Claremont. He studies under Peter Drucker.
You're going to be tag team today, so you know, you're going to have a lot of European academia sort of a little bit going on. But no, we had a West Coast reunion. And we have a bunch of people. I would say about 6,000 people went to this very small college that I attended in Switzerland for my undergraduate in economics eons ago. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of people are on the West Coast. And so they had a West Coast reunion. We had about 35 people. And we spent about 4 days together. And it was very interesting. It kind of echoed a little bit about what we do on the show, where just, you know, like talking to some people. I haven't seen some of them for over 20 years. Some people that were maybe even older than me, and how everybody is like on their journey. Everybody's their own life's journey, and where you thought you were at the age of 20 and where you are at the age of 50, and if somebody had told you the things that would encounter along the way, you would probably tell them they were crazy.
Give us a sense of who those people are. I'm assuming this is sort of an elitist school of people. There's not a lot of poor people went to the school, and probably not a lot of what
actually
we would consider
minorities. I would say that there were a lot of people that were, you know, comfortable.
Yeah.
You got to put it into context. A lot of the people that attended that school may have attended the high school before, an American high school before in Switzerland, which was actually set up to provide an academic environment for children of people who were serving either in NATO,
right,
or at the United Nations,
right,
but believe it or not, it was actually very much about the military presence in Europe, the build-up of the military presence in Europe, that people needed to have somewhere that was
an English-speaking
education.
Usually an American school and all these four.
And then, you know, kids graduated. Where are they going to go? Well, some of them didn't want to go to the United States, so they set up a college, and that's how that kind of happened. So we did have definitely people that were very connected, people that even were from from ruling families, people who were industrialists. We had people from ruling families from the United Arab Emirates without specifically calling out whatever countries. We had people that that were from industrialists, but we also had people, believe it or not, that were work study, that were actually from California. And we had people that we had to set up sort of like almost like a job placement in the college.
Only reason I call you out is because I suspect that it was kind of an elitist institution, we would consider to be elitist. These are not the average, these aren't working class families. These aren't minority families. These aren't Hispanics and African Americans and others.
He challenges me.
Come on.
To link all of this stuff together for the show, right? So
I'm just trying to get a picture.
You're actually unconsciously teeing me up here, right? Because here's the thing. You are exactly doing what most people do.
Yeah.
Okay?
Categorizing.
You're categorizing and stereotyping. Okay? And it's the them and the me.
Right.
Right?
There's my group and there's another tribe.
Right. And yet this is exactly the epidemic that is killing this country.
I don't disagree.
I'm not putting you on the spot. I'm just saying that this kind of links directly to some of the conversations that we're going to have here with our guests.
Can I give you a strange, though? I'll come full circle here, because I would have been and could have easily been one of those, not a classmate of yours because I'm older, but to that institution or one like it. My father was offered a job in the 70s, right before the oil crisis, if you remember that, under Jimmy Carter, when the oil embargo hit and changed everything. And my father was offered a job to run Chrysler's entire international program out of Switzerland. And so we accepted the job. We had to come back because he said, once we go, we may never come back to the States. Once you get out of the you get into the international division, you don't just instantly come back. And so we thought about it. We said, okay, it was 1970. I was 13 or 12 at the time. And then the oil crisis hit, and the job was canceled, the program was canceled, and we moved to Detroit for the third time. But we were on our way to Switzerland in 1970. And wondered, I've always wondered my whole life what my life would have looked like if I'd gone to, I was going to enroll in the American school there.
Yeah.
And I would have grown up in that world.
So really, you're picking on me because you have a sense of loss of something.
That's
okay,
right.
I get it. I understand now. Right. Okay. I feel
like I went back to Detroit.
In the words of Slick Willie, I feel your pain. Okay. All right. So let me introduce my guest. And I would say Ahmed, but it's an interesting story because I think people from our part of the world, originally from the Middle East, we have this thing with names when we come to the United States.
Yeah.
Okay. Bassam becomes Sam and Muhammad becomes Mike. And, you know, I think we try to make it easier, right? And I think my guest today is, and people are going to be seeing it as well as listening to it, is I'm going to say Ahmed Zahra, but you're going to say
Ahmad Zahra.
And Ahmad is—it's interesting because I mean—and you're sitting here listening to this. I saw you, so you know you're kind of nodding your head. You have your story is sort of similar. I mean, where you were, what path you were on, and then what you ended up being on, and what you're pursuing now. I mean, it's just all sort of that fabric of your life, right? Did you at early point in your life think that this is where your life journey was going to take you?
I knew exactly where I was going to
go. Oh, okay, good.
So well, give us the story.
This should be a very short show then.
Rod knows the story. No, I know a little bit because you were here earlier and we were talking about it, but give us the quick summary.
Give people a little bit of background. I mean, I know, look, you've been involved in film, right? You've been involved in the Democratic Party in California. Right. You've been involved
I've had many lives.
Well, let's back up before that because you're from, I gather, from Syria.
So here's a little bit of my background. So I was born in Damascus, Syria.
Right.
My father was a doctor. He took us when I was a child. He took the family to England.
Okay.
And we because he wanted to do his specialty. And that's where I grew up. Mm-hmm. I grew up in England. I did not go to any specific special school. I went to public school all my life.
Mm. In England.
In England. But we were up in the Northeast in Newcastle. It was working
class
families.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, working families. Those were my friends mm-hmm. and neighbors, and that's the life I sort of opened my eyes to. English was my first language. I did not know anything about Syria. And
how old were you when you made the move?
So we were about I want to say a year and a half to something like that when we moved, and then when we moved back, I remember having my 11th birthday in Damascus.
Wow!
So that was my life, and it was a continuous stay.
Right.
So we never really had any contact.
So you didn't go on like vacations or anything?
No, I mean, this was back in the 70s, so it's not like, you know, people would pick up and go, and flights were
expensive.
And your father was there for his specialization, so
exactly.
That was a full time.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But we, you know, I remember, in fact, even as a Muslim family, we didn't really, you know, my parents were somewhat secular in those days, and I ended up just going to Sunday school with my friends. Mm-hmm. I really did not know anything of who I was or who I really was.
Right.
And I was always suspicious of my dad because he never wanted to buy me a crucifix every time I wanted to buy one.
Mm-hmm.
And now my reasoning for buying that was because I wanted to fight off vampires. That was the only reason, nothing else.
Vampire. They come in handy for that.
Yeah. In Newcastle, yes.
Because I was fascinated with horror movies growing up. I was fascinated with movies in general. It's this world that you can create.
And, right.
And so that was sort of how I grew up. With this
so your
idea.
Father was leaving you defenseless to vampires,
basically. Yeah, I had mm-hmm. nightmares, honestly. In some, you know, I had this recurring nightmare that Dracula was coming to get me. And
you know, I don't wish to.
Well, if anybody is familiar with Newcastle, I mean, Newcastle is one of those older, you know, industrial towns. In
coal, isn't it?
It was coal, yeah.
It was coal, and so there are probably a lot of streets that inspire a kid's imagination to go there.
We had adventures. There was this old church in our neighborhood, and we'd go and just pretend that we would be under attack by all kinds of monsters. And the church is still there.
You raise a fascinating point.
Do you remember the name of the church?
Oh, no, I don't remember that.
So go ahead. Paul, what were you going to say?
I hope this doesn't offend anybody, but I never thought about it, that a crucifix, a Christian symbol, is what keeps the vampire way. So if that's true, what do you do in Muslim or Buddhists or other...
How do other religions ward off vampires?
Yeah, how do you ward off vampires in India or in Pakistan?
Yeah, what I discovered when we moved back is that our culture do not have vampires.
Yeah, we
so we don't need to fend them off because they just don't exist.
Yeah, they leave us alone.
We have something. We have a whole another set of ghouls and monsters and.
Well, we elected demons. Our vampire to be president, so I just know.
Okay.
No comment on that.
Okay.
But that's pretty much what it is. And when one day my dad said, okay, we're moving back.
Uh-huh.
And I said, okay, where are we going? And they, you know, I had a picture of my grandparents, or I was told my grandparents, under some trees.
Uh-huh.
And I thought I was moving back to some forest.
Mm. Okay.
And it was, you know, talking about a journey. I mean, here I was, you know, a 10-year-old kid, and my dad drove us back all the way from Newcastle to Damascus. Mm-hmm. We drove back through Europe.
How do you drive back over the channel?
It's a boat.
Oh, you literally, took the car in all
the way. Yes, literally.
Okay, didn't know
it wasn't that long ago. They had boats.
Yeah, we did have, yeah.
Okay. I know they have a tunnel.
No, but that was before the tunnel.
I didn't know that you could take a boat and put your car in it and drive back.
No, they are boats that specialize in
the ferries. This is a ferry.
Okay.
How do you think they get around to the Shetland Islands, for example?
How long did you take to go from Newcastle to Damascus, Syria?
It was a 2-week journey. And it was, for me, as a kid.
How old were you?
I was 10, about 10.
So you were conscious. I mean, you knew you were going from different countries.
Of course.
Wow, what a cool adventure.
Yeah, it was the best adventure I ever had.
And did you look forward to it, or did you fight it, or did you?
It was mixed feelings, because I had to give up my dog.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sad. I had to give up my friends.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it was really exciting, because I was going somewhere new. And I've always loved adventure as a kid. I like imaginations. I used to pretend the garage was some spaceship and I was mm-hmm. traveling. You know, my favorite sci-fi show growing up was Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
It was all about traveling. Sure. So traveling was kind of part of my personality.
All right, so now you're loving it.
What do you think of the new casting of a woman in the Doctor Who role?
I'm surprised. I mean, I've been talking about it forever. You know, so I'm finally I get my wish because, you know, growing up, there was always hints in the old show.
Right.
Growing up, they would hint to it.
Right.
And I was always surprised. Like, why are you hinting to something that you're not going to do?
But, I mean, we're geeking out here, right? A little bit for anybody who's a Doctor Who fan. Basically, the Doctor reincarnates every once in a while. And you don't know, and that's just like actually a perfect way to basically recast the role, right? But this last recasting, this reincarnation, is supposedly a woman.
Yeah, so that's the 13th reincarnation. The
13th reincarnation of Doctor Who.
And finally, it is...
Yeah. As long as the TARDIS is there, I'm okay. So, you know, I understand the TARDIS will still be
there. I think it'll be a great show.
So, you know what we're talking about, Paul, or no?
I'm not a big Doctor Who fan, but I'm familiar with the franchise. Yeah. I was really at English. You got to really be English and like English stories to like that Doctor Who stuff.
But moving back, I mean, when I moved back to Syria, these are things I missed. I mean, we did not get Doctor Who in Syria.
Right. So what time frame was this in what period of
this? This was late 70s. We moved back, and turning 80, and I had to learn Arabic in 3 months to join the public school in Syria.
Right, because you have to,
right?
Arabic as a language.
I remember the first time, very vividly, the first time we arrived.
You poor guy, at 10 years old, you needed to learn Arabic.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, anybody who is. Had the pleasure or the pain of actually being exposed to that language knows exactly it is a hard language to pick up, I would think, especially older.
It is, and my parents never spoke to us in Arabic when we were growing up.
Fascinating.
They wanted to learn English through us. So we just, and they didn't want us to feel different in that culture, because we didn't have, there weren't Arabs, there weren't Muslims.
Especially in places like Newcastle.
At that time, they weren't. Now it's populated. But at that time...
I remember the same period of time. I mean, I had an uncle who was a professor in Manchester University, and I spent a lot of time in Manchester University, in Manchester, a suburb called Sale, for all those friends of mine that may listen that know exactly what I'm talking about. But I remember... It was not. I mean, this was A, not London,
right?
And B, you did not have that diversity.
No.
I mean, it was very pleasant. I never recall any negativity per se, but it wasn't like. So I have a question for you. Do you think that while you were in the UK, while you were in Newcastle, was there an effort by your parents to kind of just completely assimilate to the point of just like shedding that background, or was it there in the house but not really?
I honestly, I never had this conversation with them. I mean, what their reasoning was. I know that they wanted to learn English, and that's why they spoke to us in English, and that's one of the things. I think also it's probably because they just weren't so put off by the Western culture.
Yeah.
In those days, there was no animosity between Eastern and Western.
No, it was you embraced it, actually.
Yeah, and so going there and assimilating and being part of that culture was something normal. It didn't really...
Well, they didn't.
I don't think they thought of it that much.
The funny thing, I think, also, that because it's the UK, right?
Yeah.
There was a connection with that part of the world that was historically there. You know, I'm not saying just Lawrence, but in terms of Egypt, in terms especially with the Green Crescent, you know, Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, I think there was a connection that you know Anglophiles basically, right? So I think both ways, people who maybe were from that part of the world that were now finding themselves in the UK, like your parents, there was a sort of an affinity to the West, and I think the Westerners there were also there was no threat. There was no sense of threat from that part of the world, because it was sort of known. It's the Orient.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
I remember there were times when, and this I kind of got to experience a little later as we would go back and visit. We kept our contacts, and we'd go back in the summertime and visit and so on. And I remember we would be asked, where are you from?
Mm-hmm.
My mom would always say Turkey, because she would not, when she would say Syria,
mm-hmm.
people wouldn't know where it was.
Right.
So she would, just to cut the conversation, she would just say Turkey.
So she was trying to help them.
Right.
So can I ask, again, I hope if I'm going too far, tell me to stop, but I know Syria, I know something about Syria, and I know it's a very divided country with lots of groups that don't get along well or that have struggled to get along well. And particularly religious groups. You've got the Sunnis and the Shiites split in Islam, but you've also got the Alawites that Bashar al-Assad and his family, apparently the Alawites somehow got into the military and the Air Force and other sorts of groups, and when Syria became free from the French, then they became a ruling group, even though they're a minority within the country there. And then you got all these other groups that I'm even struggled to come up with understand.
So to Paul's point, when you moved back, you were conscious, you're, you know, 11-year-old, basically, you've just gone through this journey across Europe, and then you find yourself in Syria.
Yeah.
What was that like?
So I'll share with you a couple of moments that really stood out for me. One is the first time I ever had an Arabic style, Middle Eastern style breakfast with olives and mm-hmm. olive oil and hummus and, thing, mm-hmm. and pita bread was actually in Turkey. We stopped along the way in this little town. I don't remember which town it was, but it was a little town. It was raining and it was nighttime and we needed a hotel, and my mom was a little picky and she didn't like any of the hotels we stopped at. They were, you know, not to her liking. And finally we stopped this couple, the young couple, who we asked them for a hotel. They tried to help. They didn't speak any English or Arabic. They just spoke Turkish. So it was very, you know, it was weird for me to see my dad trying to communicate with them. But then finally, when they all gave up, they took us to their home.
Mm-hmm.
And they had this big home, and I remember waking up the next morning in a, you know, what looked like really very strange for me, the way everything was designed, and the furnishing and unusual for what I was used to. And then we had this wonderful breakfast, and it was just things that I, you know, green olives and things that we didn't really grow up eating in England.
Right.
So, you know, I grew up eating cornflakes. That's yes.
Bangers. And, right. Yeah.
And so that was the first experience that, wow, this is going to be interesting. It's very different than what I'm used to. The second time when we actually arrived in Damascus, mm-hmm. and it was not a forest, as I thought. It was, pretty brown.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember going in, and the whole family, I guess my father had called in saying we were coming, and the whole family were sitting there. And I remember them all talking to me in Arabic, and I did not understand anything they were saying. Nothing. And all I was doing was just smiling and just standing there, sitting there and just smiling and feeling very, very awkward. But at the same time, I felt, wow, there's something so familiar.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't just, they weren't strangers. It's just I did not know how to communicate with them.
So I guess what I was getting at is, and I don't know where your family falls in the spectrum, if what group they belong to, but did you suddenly find out, oh, my God, not only, I'm not just Syrian, I have to be part of one of these groups.
Well, how did you embrace that identity?
That was later. So, for me, I was an outsider still. Like, I was able to see things from the outside.
Right.
And so there were times as I started getting older and older and getting more familiar, and I learned Arabic, I started getting, I'm quite opinionated, and I would get into these discussions with some of the elders in the family or my uncles. And I remember, a lot of times it's when I realized that people don't view each other in the same way.
Hmm.
They don't view each other the way that there is a difference between people, or that's what from the conversation. So, for example, in a conversation about the political climate, mm-hmm. there was always a reference to the Alawites.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember in one conversation I kind of budged in. It was a bunch of, you know, older guys talking, and I said, you know, I'd like to ask, do you have a problem with the government because it is a authoritarian, a dictatorship, or is it because it's Alawi?
Mm-hmm. And, is it because of the bias?
Or because they're Alawites.
Right. And the Alawites are minority in that country, right?
Right. And I think no one, they didn't expect that question from, I think I was 14, and no one expected that question. And, of course, they shut me up and I got kicked out of the room. But but that was the first impression the first political kind of impression I had.
Well, I think this is kind of an important point, because I think it happens everywhere. I personally believe it's part of a human DNA. Okay, this sort of discriminatory bias, I think, is very much part of the human DNA.
Well, it's tribalism. We all belong to a tribe. Yeah.
Right. But I, and as much as people will say we evolve and civilize and all that stuff, I think there is some part of that that is absolutely human DNA that will always be there. Now, you may manifest it in a different manner. You may navigate it in a different manner. But I don't expect people to not have it, if you will. And I think what happens with the question like you asked is it challenges – the accepted norm, that I just have an issue with the government. But it's not that these people, now that you put them in a spot where they have to basically be a bit more discerning and face the reality, whether it is because of the functioning or non-functioning of the government, or is it because I have a bias because of the Alawite, because of the tribal?
I think in general, I think humans, as human beings, we tend to always deflect blame from ourselves onto others. I think we end up projecting the blame on the issues that we have onto others. Blame is a very big thing that we do. We see that here. In the States right now, where the other is always blamed for the ills of society.
The them.
Huge, right?
The them, yeah. In every society where there's some sort of economic turmoil or there's some resentment from certain political climate, mm-hmm. there is the scapegoating is the easiest thing to do.
Sure.
And that's in every society.
I think it's a human defense mechanism.
It is somewhat. Unfortunately, it's a mechanism I'm not sure how we can overcome as humans.
Well, we keep talking about personal accountability, right? I mean, this is where I cannot take the burden of personal accountability because I have so much to deal with that it's better to deflect it in consciously or unconsciously. So what happens when you find yourself in that situation, you're in Syria? What happened next?
So, you just live life. I mean, I mean,
how long were you in the industry?
So I stayed there. I finished my junior high school. Interestingly enough, I graduated in my graduation from high school. I got the highest mark in Arabic language.
Very interesting.
So, yeah, I got 60 out of 60 in that one.
It's fantastic.
And then here's what happened. So growing up, all I wanted to do was make movies. Mm-hmm. I was fascinated with films. But I was in Syria. And
not a big film business in Syria,
not
right?
Not a big film business in Syria. And my father was a doctor. My grandfather and my great-grandfather all were doctors. Mm. My uncle was a doctor.
So you're supposed to be a doctor.
So I was supposed to be a doctor. Mm. And I got the grades for it, and I got into medical school. That was the only option I had, was mm-hmm. to actually get into that. I tried to resist. I tried to ask my dad to send me to England to study film. He would not, he kind of laughed it off, didn't think I was too serious about it. Year after, I went into medical school. I got my degree, mm-hmm. graduated. I practiced for 3 years with my dad. Mm-hmm. Even I worked with him.
And what kind of medicine did you practice?
Well, I did pathology. But at night,
dealing with dead bodies again here. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
It's that affinity to the vampire.
The closest thing I can get to films.
Yeah.
What's pathology?
Well, I liked Quincy.
Quincy. I remember Quincy.
Remember the show? I used to watch
Medical Examiner.
Lived on a boat. Had a,
right. Yeah. So I used to.
Medical Examiner.
That would be a good thing. But no, but practically speaking, it allowed me the opportunity to also work at night with my dad, who was a neurosurgeon. I assisted him in some of his work. Yes, I've done brain surgery. Mm-hmm. And also,
is it as hard as they say? It's
no,
not brain
no,
surgery.
It's not. As an assistant, it was very boring.
It
was very boring. I would stand there, behind him and just, do the suction tubes and falling asleep every now and then. The operations, they lasted 6 hours and 7 hours.
Oh, my
hours.
Goodness.
So,
wow.
Yeah. But it also allowed me the opportunity to also study for the American exams to come to the United States, because then I started thinking of another plan.
Okay.
If you could escape
Kind of. I mean, I thought there sometimes, here's the thing, you're presented sometimes with opportunities, right? And I was I thought there was an opportunity for me to get on. Find another path in life, mm-hmm. and another journey.
Even after you're a doctor? I mean, you're a pathologist, for Pete's sake. That's a pretty serious commitment. That's not like you just took a sales job or something.
Sure. So here's the thing. I always pictured medicine as the arranged marriage that I had.
Mm.
It wasn't so bad, but it wasn't really what
you
I wanted.
You weren't in love with it, yeah.
And so I ended up eloping with my mistress.
Which was film.
Yeah,
by the way, I don't know if I shared this with you before, but my uncle, he was raised in Baghdad and went to England. Actually, he was in London for medical school. And he actually graduated, and he practiced, and he was a doctor. And he hated it. And it was one of those cases where his mom was referred to from, you know, when he was a kid, as the doctor's mom, the mom of the doctor, the mom of the doctor, you know, I'm a doctor. Yeah. And that he basically pursued that path almost out of expectation. And all he wanted to do, he was always fascinated by business and what have you. And he ended up basically having really a kind of a rough time of it, trying to come to terms with what he wanted to do. And then he's now basically doing business, but he's doing business consulting on hospital development. Mm, right, so it's right. A sort of a marriage of the two, right?
But I did not do that. I didn't hate studying.
We got to jump ahead a little faster because we're running out of time here. All right, so now how did you elope and where did
but hold on,
run off to?
I wanted to find out. Okay, you're in Syria.
Rod wants us to be 2 hours.
Hold on. No. You're in Syria. You are fascinated by film. You go and pursue a medical degree. Were you doing anything to satisfy or even explore that side of you,
film side of you? Just watching movies.
Absolutely nothing.
Nothing, just watching movies.
Wow. Okay.
What could you do to explore it?
There's nothing. It's Damascus.
No film production going on.
But I really wanted to finish, you know, what I started. I don't like to just ditch things as well. So I wanted to give it the full, you know, the full...
give it a shot.
Complete.
Benefit of the doubt, if you will, and just go through that whole
So how did you run off with your mistress? Let's get to the...
Well, I had an opportunity to come to the United States, and I took it. I said, okay, I'm... And when I arrived here, I thought, you know, and I remember standing... my first stop was in New York, and I went to see the Statue of Liberty, and I stood there in awe of this and thought, okay, this is the land of freedom, and now I am free to do whatever I want. And that was it. And I thought, okay, it's time now.
So
the old world, old life.
So what do you do?
You
just give up being a doctor and you just go be a starving waiter and try and get into film here or something?
That's exactly what I did.
Wow.
Yeah, that's exactly what I did. I got a car, drove west, and got into Hollywood. I remember... I didn't know anyone, so from one friend to the other, as I started meeting people, I ended up trying to find an apartment in Hollywood, and I couldn't, and I ended up sleeping on somebody's couch for like 2 months. And then finally, you know, one night I found myself sleeping in my car, trying to find a place. And then if it weren't for one last apartment complex that I found, and I said, please, could you please give me rent me this place? She was Israeli, an Israeli immigrant. I was a Syrian immigrant, and we kind of found a connection somehow.
The immigrant experience?
Yeah, and she said, okay, I'll trust you, and I'll get you an apartment, but you better get a job quickly.
So how do you get a job in Hollywood? I've been there. It ain't easy. You can't just go knock on the door.
Waiting tables. That's the first thing you do.
Right.
And I didn't mind any of that because I knew I was pursuing what
Here
I
you are, a pathologist.
You yeah.
You're a pathologist for Pete's sake, and you're waiting tables. Your parents must have been horrified.
They were, and, you know, they had problems. They gave problems. But, you know, the thing is that you... No matter what people say, you have to keep doing what you believe is right for you. And this is what, life is a journey. And if you don't, and we only have one, that one journey, right? But if you don't take this,
at least we think
road,
so.
Some think you get to come back
2-3 times. But.
Exactly. But if you don't walk this, the road, you're just, I mean, it's a very,
so why do,
journey.
So what, from your own experience, because I mean, it takes, I think, guts and bravery to do that. Okay, I mean, most people, it's frightening. It's frightening to trust, to let go of that edge of that pool, right? I mean, to give up being a pathologist and
wait tables? Yeah, that'd be a little frightening.
Tables, right? So I think a lot of people, that's where they get paralyzed.
Right.
Right.
So here's the little thing. So I think this is my mom's fault.
You're listening, Mom.
One of the lessons in life that I learned was from the lifeguard that taught me how to swim. We were 14. I was 14, and we were in a resort town in Syria. And I didn't know how to swim. And my mom called this guy, and I was afraid to swim. I didn't know what to do, and And so she called this guy in, and he came, and he said, "Okay, I'll teach your kid." So he took me to the edge of the pool and said, "Okay, I'll teach you how to swim." And he grabbed onto me. I thought he was going to jump in with me or something, and then he just took me and just dropped me in.
Sink or swim.
Yeah. And then I remember sinking all the way down and then finding my way up, and then I floated, and I swam back to the edge. And he said, "You see, that's the lesson you have to learn. Jump, and then you will learn how to swim. And don't worry about drowning. You won't."
Some do, though.
Interesting. No,
all right, so we really got to move this along, guys. We've got like 10 or 15 minutes to go through.
So what happens in Hollywood?
In Hollywood, you know, doors open, doors close. One thing led to another. I worked on big movies. I worked on small movies. I ended up making my own movies. I moved to Orange County.
So what was the first job you had in Hollywood in the movies?
A real job.
I was an intern, and then got hired as an assistant, and then another assistant
And what did you do in the studio system? You said you worked in some studio.
I was an assistant to a producer, and
that's a powerful job, actually.
I learned producing there. Yeah. And
any films we'd know or anything here?
The first film I worked on was interesting. It was it's called Woman on Top. It was Penelope Cruz's first movie, and I remember driving her around in my car, going around shopping for like clothes for the film. And
how cool is that? So Penelope Cruz, she's hot.
It was pretty cool. Yeah. I mingled with stars and stuff. It was an interesting time, but I still wanted to make my own movies, and that's when I moved to Orange County. I found that there was a Muslim Arab community there. I thought, okay, that might be my niche.
To make ethnic films, or
to raise funds from people who may want to give an Arab some money.
That, you know? Yeah, right, right.
And I moved to Orange County into Fullerton, and I've been there since, August 2001.
Mm-hmm. Been there some time.
And then a month later, 9/11 happened.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yikes.
Yeah, right. And so everything changed for me, because while I was trying to pursue my first horror film, suddenly,
you were living a horror film.
There was a horror film. I was living on my own, and we were all living. And I started getting a lot of calls from Muslim organizations, nonprofit organizations, advocacy groups who were trying to put out some sort of message of unity. And I started doing all these videos, and I found myself in that mix. I was the guy they were calling, because I was the only one doing this. And then a year later, I found myself following a group of three groups, Muslim, Christian, and Jewish, who went down to Mexico to build a house for a poor family there. And I followed them. I documented their journey, and that became the first film I actually ever did.
Which is
called Uncommon Grounds. And it follows this journey, and I was able to we screened it everywhere. I got it on television. I got it on the Hallmark Channel of all places.
Well, so what was the basic element of the movie?
It was about how we need to focus on the commonalities that we all share, rather than worry about and bicker over the differences. And
very timely message,
right? And so, you know, and that really became the basis of the philosophy that kind of became the basis of all the movies that I did after that.
Okay.
So and how many movies did we got about 10 minutes left? So how many movies did you do?
I did about 4 feature films. I did about several. I don't know, like 10 documentaries, and I did a bunch of short films. We also helped students to get their start, because I always wanted to encourage people when I didn't have anybody encouraging me. I wanted to
be
encourage
there for
people.
Them.
Right. So I started an internship program with Cal State Fullerton. I brought in we raised about $30,000 to do the first thesis film they had to be done on film, as opposed to video. And then some of the films later on that I brought, I actually shot in Fullerton so that we can hire local actors as well. So I was always trying to encourage, you know, new talent to.
So there was more to it than just just the making of the films, for you, there are all these other additional elements that you like to be involved in. Community give back, support.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Because I felt that, you know, just like this, you know, that my story and my journey isn't just about me. Mm-hmm. It is about helping others. I've had a lot of help along the way in my American journey, and I wanted to give back and also lend a hand. And I did it in the way I knew, which was to encourage people and maybe train them or give them opportunity in some of these films I was doing.
And we're trying to figure out a way to actually work with you on the Arab American Legacy.
Right. So there are a lot of these projects that I wanted to do. I mean, I like to document history. I like to document
Still have it.
Right. Exactly.
We still have these people.
You know, there's a lot of things that we do in our communities that sometimes go unnoticed, and, mm-hmm. and video is a very good way of document that.
As president of the Historical Society in San Clemente, I find that that is one of the things that probably happens more than we know. All the wealth, the knowledge base, the experience, the background, all this stuff for just the common people. And their stories fascinating, especially on the local level, right, that disappear. Because once that person is gone, you don't have that reference unless they pass it on to somebody else. And you are doing something, I'm assuming at this point, Fullerton is home.
Fullerton is home. I lived there with my spouse for about, we've been together for 15 years, and we call it home. I've been there for 16 years, in the same place, the same area, and I wanted, and now I feel like I you know, with what's going on now, I feel like I need to even step up my game in trying to give back to the place I call home.
So what are you doing in Fullerton?
And so I kind of stepped into politics a little bit.
What?
Uh-oh.
From pathology to film to politics? Oh, my goodness. Sir.
It's all connected. No? It's all connected. It's one, it's, you know,
well,
it's all about helping someone else.
And what is it that you want to do in politics? We're kind of about 5-6 minutes
left there. So I decided to, I didn't want to go big right away.
Run for governor right away.
Right.
President, maybe. Yeah.
It's a little too soon. But I really wanted to help my neighbors and the folks that I call my friends and that I interact with every
Well, your
every
neighborhood
day.
Is now a new district, right?
It is a new district, yeah. So it's District 5.
Fullerton just got districted,
It's the southeast, yeah. We're going districting. And I thought, and it's an opportunity that opened up. I found myself being somebody who lived in that area, who knows the area, knows the struggles of that area. And I thought I'd like to be represent that area.
And what does that district look like?
It's working families. It has an industrial part. Interestingly, it has a higher Latino population than other districts, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, my family for the past 15 years, my spouse is Mexican, and my family have been the Mexican family for the past 15 years. Mm-hmm. And so I know the struggles. I know what they go through. Because as an immigrant myself, I go through the same,
sure.
I've went through the same struggles as
so
well.
So you've certainly traveled through many tribes. You were, thought you were just a regular English kid and didn't know Arabic. And then suddenly you come back and you're thrust into the tribal world of Syrian life and one tribe versus another. And then suddenly you're an American and you're an outsider again. And suddenly then you marry into the Hispanic family and you're bonding over the shared immigrant experience of only in America.
Only in America. And this is, that's the beauty of life. You don't know where you're going, but what you've got to stick to the principles that you believe in. And I've always believed in trying to be a good role model, mm-hmm. and also helping others.
How many people are running in the district, and what are you up against?
So far, there's only me and another person who announced
for
that district. There's it is an open seat. So there's no incumbent.
Right, it's a new district.
The political elites of Fullerton don't actually live in that area. It's not considered, you know, one of the best areas. It's working.
But you've had a brush in already on this thing that you were trying to do with the clean and green effort in Fullerton, right?
Right. So I've been involved with the local politics for a while. I mean, I've been, you know, I go in and do my share of
You're a known face of the city council.
Yes. Yeah. Often I you know they know me, but I presented something recently. It's called the Clean and Green City Resolution. It's basically just reaffirming the city's commitment to fighting pollution and climate change. Mm-hmm. And the reason I did this, it is a non-binding resolution. It is right. more symbolic than anything. It right. basically lists all the things that the city's doing, but it's more of a statement of intent.
We stand for this.
Right, exactly. And what I wanted to do with this is have the city declare something so that the citizens know, the residents know that the city's doing something, mm-hmm. that it's got their back. Mm-hmm. We have a water, I don't know if you've heard about the water pollution in our northern basin. So it is right now at critical level. So
is that from industrial?
It is from industrial. Right. It's been going on for a while. And so when you open the water tap and you're drinking that water and you think, okay, is the city doing something or not? So this is something that I thought the city could benefit from by at least announcing that we are doing something.
Our own little Flint, Michigan.
Right. Otherwise, yeah. And also it helps the city by putting all the things that it's been doing in one document. It kind of focuses their
It highlights their, what the city's efforts are. Yeah.
Exactly.
Right. How tough is it to run? What kind of money do you have to raise? Is it just putting your name and knocking on doors?
It's going to be knocking on doors. Luckily, I know many of the doors
already.
I know the neighborhood quite well. And I think that it will take a lot, money. Unfortunately, politics requires some money. You've got to reach people.
But these municipal races, it's a lot of shoe leather and beating on doors.
I would think it's more than there's no ads. Maybe you run ads in papers and mailers and stuff.
Slate mailers and stuff like that.
But it's mostly about, connecting with people. And that's what I would like to do. I mm-hmm. think I do well connecting with people. I'm hoping to be able to do that even further.
Happened with this green and clean?
It went through. I got it on the agenda finally, and then but then it went up for the first time in front of the council. We had only three members of the council, there at that time present. The mayor decided he wanted to vote no on it. So we got two out of one. However, because the other two council members were not present, we didn't have a full quorum, so they ended up tabling it for the next agenda. So we have another shot at it. I don't expect it to pass, honestly. The other two
what
are
was
not.
The, what was the reservation?
The reasoning? The reasoning is saying, he was contradictory, really, because at one point he said this is ineffective, it doesn't do anything, it's symbolic, and then on the other hand he said it was overreaching and went too far. So I'm not sure which one it is. In both cases, it's what the city's already doing, so I don't know how overreaching it can be.
Fascinating.
Yeah. This is the nature of local politics, and you keep pushing within,
We say it here. We see it here, and Paul is the first one who said it, is every all news is
local.
Right, exactly.
It's local.
Great
exactly.
Tip O'Neill.
But the mayor did himself a disservice by saying no, because he could have just said yes and let it go. I mean, it
wouldn't have been any additional.
And no, but now it's gotten this out of proportion, because now I can't control even the. We had 20 people come out and speak for this last time in the last meeting. We're going to have even more this time. There's going to be a rally. I don't even know how people are organizing anymore.
Well, this is the thing that's fascinating about local politics, right? I mean, to your point, and I'm not picking on the mayor of Fullerton per se, but she uses it as an example, is that was a situation where most of the stuff was already being done by the city, from my understanding. And for you to stand up and basically put yourself as a resistive figure to something that's already happening makes you a target.
Right. It didn't make sense to me why he would say no. It could have just, said yes. It was a good feel, a feel-good kind of resolution. We moved on and we...
And leave it alone.
And leave it alone. But now it just got out of I think is going to get out of hand.
It will get out of hand, and it'll turn into, what are you covering? Why are you trying to protect the industry from doing its right thing? And blah blah blah.
And what does Fullerton look like? I'm assuming it's a conservative community, and it's probably mostly Republican.
It's not. I mean, it's really a very diverse city.
How many districts?
We have 5 districts. Okay. It's 140,000 population, divided equally among the districts. We have a 30% Asian population. We have a 30% Latino population, and the rest, of course, are white and miscellaneous. Miscellaneous.
I'm a miscellaneous too, right?
but so it is a diverse city, and so I think we are not, we don't have proper representation. Also, the South part, which I'm hoping to represent, is a little run down. It doesn't get the attention that other districts, have gotten along the years. I mean, the street I live on hasn't been paved for 15 years since I moved into that street.
Which is why many of these cities have moved towards districting, like Anaheim, because they felt that a handful of people who lived in the more affluent town tended to run the cities.
Right.
And so you had 4 or 5 people who all lived in one narrow section of the city. I don't know if that's true in Fullerton. But
Somewhat true. And so, I think that by having somebody representing that district, I think we can at least bring some attention to it. We have a higher pollution, air pollution than other parts of the city because we're closer to the 91 freeway. There's less trees because most of the green open space is in the northern part of the city. So we do have a lot of work to do. Bring in actual good developments, affordable housing, and maybe provide incentives for homeowners to fix up their homes because we have a lot of rundown homes in our neighborhoods as well.
See, I find it fascinating because, to Paul's point about going from pathology to movies
film
to politics, right?
Politics, yeah.
I think there is a common thread, and you said it. It's the sort of being of service to others.
Yes.
And it's interesting because I think what you're about to go into is going to make you already said it was boring. I was going to say makes pathology seem like a walk in the park because this is being involved in local politics is not for the faint-hearted. And I think especially if your intentions is to unite and find common ground, that's a very interesting effort nowadays, especially with the climate.
Yeah, it's tough, but I tell people, look, I got through Hollywood and I didn't know anyone. I got to make my movies.
Right.
I got to make my dream come true.
Right.
I think if I can make it in Hollywood, I can make it anywhere.
I think when it comes to person
That's
to person,
true.
If you can break through that sort of bias. It actually is. There is a lot of common grounds. I think it's just like which jersey are you going to wear today to represent what team?
Yeah, I'm not talking about you, but
I'm just saying in general.
My philosophy is that service to people, service to others, does not require a team.
It can be an individual effort?
It can be an individual effort. You don't need labels. You don't need titles. You don't need a jersey of some sort. You can just go out and do something good. Knock on your neighbor's door and say, are you doing okay?
Right. You don't have to belong to it.
It could be as simple as that. One of the things that I'm hoping that I could achieve with my run is at least inspire people to do something like that. I've been doing a lot of these little efforts locally that try to bring people together. I'm using some of my films. So I'm doing the first film I ever did. It's now 15 years since I did that. And so I'm hosting a 15-year anniversary sort of a retrospective of interfaith work in Orange County. And we're doing that at the Fulton Community Center.
Are you talking about the movie Common
Grounds? Yes, on Common Grounds. It will screen August 10th, the Fulton Community Center. Everybody's welcome to come. I'm inviting everybody. I've invited our city council, our mayor. Despite our differences, I think we have a lot of commonalities. And our goal, ultimately, is the same. Our goal is the same. Maybe our methods is we differ on our methods, but the goal is the same.
So I wish we had more people that were motivated by that approach, at least on the municipal level, and that we don't get tied up and twisted in all these other things. I think your movie 15 years ago is probably going to be even more timely today, to be honest.
I think so.
I'm, you know, fortunate or unfortunate that, you know, the climate is the way it is today. We need more people talking and telling and reminding us that we have more common than we have that's that divides us.
And we need more time, but we're out. So how do they reach
how
you?
How do they get hold of
How do they find you? Where do they get the website? You must have a campaign website. And what the election
know, I just,
is...
I'm just starting my campaign. I don't have...
Here, kicked it off today.
Yes, I officially filed, and I am running.
So but how do people find you?
You can find me on Facebook. My profile is public. You can. I don't hide anything. I like transparency.
When's the election? In November?
Just find me on Facebook, Ahmad Zahra.
Spell it for people.
AhmadZahra.
And when's the election?
And my company, if you want to check out my movies, it's ZahraPictures.com, Z-A-H-R-A, Pictures.com.
And On Common Grounds is airing in Fullerton,
On where? Common Grounds is going to be August 10th. Fullerton City Community Center.
Okay.
At 5:30.
At 5:30.
Yeah. And when's the election?
November 7th, I think, 2018, which will be my birthday.
Wow.
Okay. So not this November, but a year from now.
A year from now, yes. From I'm now. Starting a bit early.
All right. Yeah. Well, you know, it worked for somebody in the White House. Started a year early. But, you know, I appreciate you coming because I think it's really important to, again, remind people of things, A, that unite us, but also that, as you said, to trust in your own personal journey and to stay true to your own principles.
Yeah, exactly.
Along that way.
Rod loves that story. He loves to hear people that have just taken the...
Don't you?
Taken the path least traveled.
But don't you? I think everybody's life is a path that he's traveled, to be honest, because you never sit down and plan it. I mean, very few people put it on paper and follow it.
And when you have to jump, just jump. You'll learn how to swim later.
There you go.
And we'll end with that. Thank you, everybody, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And... please let us know what you think of the show. Again, The Rad Life, every Wednesday at 12 to 1. And you can reach me on Facebook as well. And you can reach me also through octalkradio.net. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.
You have been listening to The Rad Life Radio Show with your host and age explorer, Rad Gontos. Brought to you on the one and only octalkradio.net. Join us again next week as we continue our journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older.